I mentioned last week is really for us to wrap up Megillat Rut this week and next week, and we're going to be already giving it short shrift of, you know, certainly the fourth parak, in order to do that. So let's use the time that we have. Once again, I thank Dana and Ilan Rubinstein for dedicating the year's classes. Also, this session is dedicated by Ann and Shlomi Romberg in memory of Pinya and Hendel Rondeberg, Hashem Yikom Damam, who were killed in the pogrom in Kielce. And their yard site is, I believe, today. And also a refuah for Zev Yisrael ben Esther. So we are in Perek Gimel in Chapter 3, and where we left off was a discussion of the six barleys, right? Sheish Seorim, that Boaz measures out for Ruth, before she goes home and before he goes into the city after that whole, night in the granary. So we said a simple read of this is that he's giving her food. It's a present. Straightforward. Simple and straightforward. But we had some hints in the text that something else is going on. We said, first of all, in chapter 3, sentence 15, it said he measured to her six barleys. If you're giving six barley stalks, then you count them out, you don't measure them, right? It's like when people use the word amount inappropriately, or less versus fewer, or something like that. You measured out, you don't measure out a number of stalks. And if the answer is, so it wasn't a number of stalks, it wasn't six barley stalks, rather it was six units, six isaron, or whatever it is, it still connotes precision. And the question is, why was he so precise in what he gave her? That's number one. Number two, in sentence 17, we saw that Ruth gave her report to Naomi of what Boaz had done, and she singled out these six barleys, indicating that there's something special about them. And also, we said, it says Sheish HaSeorim, which could be read as the six. Doesn't have to be. It could just be these six pointing to them. But that also raised our curiosity. And we also had an indirect problem of how is it that Naomi knows that Boaz is planning on taking care of everything that day. So again, last time we said maybe this is just a gift and don't read anything into it. However, what we'll see now are two other approaches. Take a look at source number one, please, on your sheet. It's a Gemara in Sanhedrin. My sheish haseorim. What is that, you know, these six barleys? What is that? E lema sheish seorim mamash. If you're going to tell me it means six actual stalks, v'chi darko shel boaz litein matana sheish seorim? It's a little frugal there, giving, you know, six stalks of barley. Right? We said last time, he's a gibor chayil, and one of the meanings of chayil is wealth. Why is he giving six stalks of barley? The elashesh se'in. And if you go the other extreme and say six of barley, we said that's an awful lot of barley. We said, based on Professor Meltzer in the Dot Mikra, that a se'ah is about 36 liters of grain, which means you'd be talking about something like 216 liters of grain for her to carry home. The Gemara says, "Chidarka shel isha litol sheish se'in." Is that really? She's going to throw that on her back and walk home? Granted that she is an eshet chayil, and chayil can also connote strength. That's just not nice, giving her that amount to walk home with. Ela remez ramaz la she'asidin shisha banim latzeis mimena shemis barchin b'sheish sheish brachos. So we get an entirely different read. It is a hint to Ruth that she is going to produce six descendants who will each be blessed with six blessings. The Eluhain, and here they are, David, Mashiach, Daniel, Hananya, Mishael, Va'azaria. David, okay, Mashiach, and the rest of them are a set. Daniel, Hananya, Mishael, and Azaria, who we learned about several years ago, those who were in the shiur with me, at Shari Shemayim several years back. So the Gemara then goes on to explain how you know they each got six blessings. I brought you a summary of it in source number 2 rather than go through all of the psukim. If you take a look at source number 2, the pasuk for David is one that those who learn Shmuel with me have already seen. When David is introduced back in chapter 16 of Shmuel Aleph, I actually wrote 16:8, but I'm pretty sure that should be 18. Not 8. I think that's a typo on my part. But the pasuk there describes David. This is when they're looking for a musician for Shaul. And David is introduced as somebody who is Yodea Nagain. He knows how to play music. He's a Gibor Chai, Ish Milchama, a warrior. He is Navon Davari, speaks wisely. He's attractive, and Hashem is with him. And Mashiach is described in Yeshaya. Those who learned Yeshaya with me a few years ago, also on Tuesdays, 2 years ago, we were in Yeshaya Perek Yud Aleph. So we talked about how Mashiach is described as being someone of knowledge and understanding and counsel and strength and da'at and oh, I've got it. I didn't translate the word da'at because you get tired of translating Chochmah, Bina, da'at and pretending that you know them as different words. So I did it with Chochmah and Bina there and Eitzah, but with da'at I just got tired. So you could translate da'at as wisdom if it makes you feel better. And then in the first chapter in Daniel, right, which we did also a while back. So remember that the text describes how Nebuchadnezzar had these youths brought from the exiles, from the Jewish captives, and they were selected because they had no blemish, they were attractive, they had all kinds of knowledge and da'at. They had mada as well, a word that I didn't translate either. Does it mean secular intellectual information? Who knows? Unclear. And they also had self-control, the ability to stand in the royal court. So what the Gemara is doing here is that it's giving us a medrash that's really not so much about the 6 barley stalks that Boaz is giving Ruth. It's only tangentially about those barley stalks. What it's really doing is picking up on the fact that all 6 of these are descendants of Ruth. Because David, we know, Mashiach is a descendant of David, and Daniel, and our assumption is Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah as well, because they're with him, but Daniel, we know, is also a descendant of Yehuda, a descendant of that royal line that comes from David. So the idea here is that number one, I see the hand, hang on. We have these descendants of Ruth, happens to be 6 of them, who are associated with 6 blessings, and isn't that an interesting phenomenon? Number two, Ruth goes out of her way to comment about these 6 barley stalks. This is a special thing. And so we connect them and say, it's a message to her about the descendants that she is going to have. That is our drash here, picking up on the oddities of the text. Yes, Susan. Sorry, you're muted.
When they use the term Mashiach, do they mean, when they say descendant, so they mean a human being, not a spirit?
Mashiach is a human being. No. Mashiach is literally the anointed one. Correct. The next king to descend from the house of David.
Oh, but the word Mashiach is anointed, no?
Yes. Susan, what? So Mashiach is, if you look in the Rambam, in the Laws of Kings, in the end of the Laws of Kings, I highly recommend that as a read. His read, granted, is more rational than what some will put in there, but the Rambam says this is a king who is going to lead the Jews back to Torah, is not some supernatural person. Just somebody gifted, but not supernatural. So I'll tell you what, Susan, wait till Wednesday morning's class, because we're going to discuss that then.
Okay.
It's actually coming up in the class tomorrow morning. So, So wait and see. Or you can cheat by looking at the source sheet that I sent out yesterday for it. Yes, Ruchama and then Beruya.
No, Mashiach is anointed.
Yes, correct. Correct. Beruya.
Yeah, I was just wondering about the hint. How exactly is Ruth supposed to know that this is a hint about the sun? Like, is there anything previously anywhere that this is barley is a hint for sun?
Right, so I was wondering whether there was something about barley somehow that would connect. I couldn't think of a barley connection.
How would she know that this is a hint?
Right.
That she will have six sons and the quality.
So, for all I know, it's not meant as a hint, but rather he told her. The wording the Gemara uses is remez ramaz la. But that's more a remez to us than it is to her. It's a remez by the text. We don't know what he, you know, what he actually said, although I imagine if he had said that, the text in Ruth would have told us that.
So.
Yeah, I hear you.
Maybe they were very pretty flowers. You know, the barley had less flowers and they looked like roses or something.
I don't think people talk about barley flowers much.
I'm just kidding.
Yeah, they,
doesn't make any sense.
No. I mean, the problem that I have fundamentally with this as a solution to our questions is the word vayamad. Vayamad doesn't mean measured. It doesn't mean counted. It means measured. It doesn't really work with stocks. It also doesn't, of course, explain how Naomi knew that Boaz was going to do it that day. You just have to say, because he's a righteous man. However, the Malbim gives us another approach.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, please.
There were some very good kings that came from Malchus David.
Right, because they're picking up on the six blessings. The fact that the text actually gives us, we have a pasuk in which they receive six brachot. We don't have that for others.
Okay.
Yeah. That's what I meant when I said this Gemara is really not just a medrash about Rut, it's a medrash about the psukim with each of these descendants. Yeah. Sure. So Malbim throws in another idea. Malbim is doing something very interesting here. Going far afield from what we normally think of as biblical commentary, but into an area which is much more popular in our day. Connecting a pasuk in Tanakh with a halachic idea. And what he says before we see it in source number 3, I'll explain outside, is that this was not six stalks. It was 1/6 of a se'ah. And he says that it was popular to break down volume measures in 1/6 units. You know, the same way that with time, right? We use 60 as a very big number in our time, right? So 60 seconds in a minute, 60 minutes in an hour, right? We use units of 60. Or if you think of in the decimal system, right? Or in the metric system, we use tens, right? So 10 millimeters in a centimeter, 10 centimeters in a decimeter, whatever the numbers are. I grew up in the U.S. I just know that they all end in meter and that some people spell it E-R and some people spell it R-E. But the point here is that he says it was a thing to have 1/6 of a volume measure. And he says that's what it means. Sheish se'orim means a 1/6 unit of barley, and specifically, it was 1/6 of a se'ah, which is also known as a kav. For reference, a kav, by the numbers we've been giving, will be 6 liters. So he says, so what? The point is that we have a halachic discussion of how much you're supposed to give to a traveling pauper who is collecting food. How much are you supposed to give him to eat? And the rule based on which the source that he's about to bring is that you give him half a kav per meal. One kav should give him 2 meals. So here you're giving 1 kav to Ruth and Naomi. That will suffice to give them 1 meal, to give them breakfast, right? We'll do the math again when we see it in the Malbim. But the idea is, he's only providing food for breakfast. And by doing that, he's saying, this is going to be taken care of now. Someone actually suggested something along these lines when we were talking at the Barley last week. So take a look at source number 3. Malbim says, I'm going to read out my English translation in the interest of time, but you can see the Hebrew as well. It appears that this was a kav measure, which is 1/6 of a sa'ah, for that was their way, to divide a large unit into sixths. And he quotes you a pasuk in Yechezkel, you shall divide the ephah in sixths. This measure was called sheish, a sixth. Okay, so that's point number one. He believes it's a volume measure called a sheish. And the law is that one may not give a transient pauper less than a kikar. Kikar is a loaf of bread usually, but the point is that kikar was always half a kav. Their loaves of bread were half a kav. He gave Naomi and Ruth a kav, which is food for breakfast for the two of them. Thus, he demonstrated that the matter would be resolved that day, they would not need for the evening meal. So he specifically only gives them enough for breakfast, which explains why Boaz makes a point of telling Ruth, bring this for Naomi, right? Remember that Ruth says, he told me, go give this to Naomi, because he wants Naomi to understand he's doing it immediately, which is how Naomi knows that indeed it's going to be taken care of that day. And that fits with the idea of Vayomod, that he, first of all, it's a measured amount, it's not a counted amount, and that it's precise, right? It's precise, because this is the message he wants to convey. If he gives a little more, if he gives a little less, he's lost the point. So Malbim is very sharp in giving this explanation. Okay. So that brings us to a very difficult issue, which some of you have asked me about multiple times, and I kept saying, let's wait until the end of chapter 3. We are now at the end of chapter 3, so here we go. The problem is that if you've been following along in the Hebrew, you know, there are words in this book that we pretend are not here. We simply skip. There was a word im a few sentences back that we just pretended wasn't there. There are words which we read in this book, even though they're not there in the text, like the word Eli. So the question is, what in the world is this about? And for many people, this may be the first time they've seen this. It does exist elsewhere in Tanakh, but it's very sparse in terms of where this shows up. You're not going to find things like that in Chumash. In Chumash, you will find occasionally that a word is written one way, and we would expect a certain pronunciation, and then we pronounce it differently. So for example, easy example, when Abraham's servant goes to the well, and Rivka comes out to the well, the description of Rivka repeatedly is nun ayin resh, which people without vowels will look at and assume is na'ar, right? A young boy, a serving boy perhaps. However, it's that we masculine. What it should say is na'ara. So this is what we call in Hebrew, it's really Aramaic, kri uktiv. Kri, kuf resh yud, is the way that we read the text. Ktiv, kaf taf yud vet, is the way that the text is written. And they don't always match. Not so common in Chumash, but it exists. More common in Nach, in the prophets and the writings, and in certain books more than you find in other books. So the question is, what in the world is this about? So, as I said to you last time when I told you this was coming, some of the things you're going to hear, you're going to be like, I can't believe he said that. I don't understand that. That doesn't fit at all with what they've always told me about Torah. That's okay. You'll have an expanded experience here. So the first point that I want to make. Yes, Rose. That's it, right. So that's a different word. That's kuf resh ayin.
Okay.
Yeah, with an ayin at the end.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure. So the first thing to know is that commentators agree across the board that when you want to know what the pshat in the sentence is supposed to be. How am I supposed to understand the sentence when the Kri leads one way and the Ketiv is a different way? The answer is adopt the Kri approach. It's the way that we read it, not the way that it's written. I brought you as one example Ibn Ezra in source number 4, in which he's dealing with a pasuk I gave you in brackets, asher lo ya'adah, lo ya'adah. I'm not going into that verse in context, but he says in that verse, which is written lamed aleph, but we read it and we explain it as lamed vav. Lamed aleph is no, N-O. Lamed vav is his, H-I-S, right? So he says, you should know that it is read as lo, meaning lo with a vav, and written in the text with an aleph. And outside, the way you speak the word, and therefore the way we explain the word, is lo with a vav. And then he quotes you Rav Sadia Gaon, and he says Rav Sadia Gaon said it has two meanings. That lo, read it, in other words, read the sentence as though there are two layers of meaning. There's lo with it, there's no, and then there is his as well. And he gives you an example which is probably more familiar to people. There's a paragraph of Tehillim, Psalm 100, which is said as part of davening every morning, not on Shabbos, but during the week. It's Mizmor LeTodah. So there's a line in there in which we say about God, Hu asanu velo anachnu. Now, if you didn't know that chapter, if all you knew were the words, Hu asanu velo anachnu, how would you translate that? Exactly.
It works both ways,
precisely. So if you read it as the word lo with an aleph, hu asanu velo anachnu means he made us, we didn't make ourselves. Which is a fine lesson that everybody should learn at some point in growing up. He made us, we did not make ourselves. However, and in fact, sorry, that's the way the word is written. If you were to look in a book of Tehillim, you would see lamed aleph. However, the way it's pronounced, and don't get into the discussion of how you pronounce these differently, because we Ashkenazim, and even those who use Mivtah Eretz Yisrael, don't know how to pronounce Hebrew. And therefore, we pronounce it the same way. However, if we were purists, we would pronounce lo as though it were a vav. That's the Kri. In which case, it means he made us, and we are his. That's the way that it's supposed to be read. So, take a look at what Ibn Ezra quotes. He quotes Usajja Gaon to say that it has two meanings. He made us and lo us. One meaning, the written one, is we did not make ourselves. And the second, which is the pronounced one, is we are his. But Ibn Ezra says, to me it appears correct to say that only the second meaning is correct. You only go with the way the word is pronounced, and so in all of them. Anytime the text is written one way, pronounced a different way, just go with the way that it is pronounced. That's the meaning of the word. So says Ibn Ezra, and it's not just him. Radak says that, Malbim says that, everybody seems to say that. Based, yes, Susan?
Based on what?
So based on what's coming next.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's one point that you need to be aware of. Second point, rabbinic texts generally describe everything that is found in a Torah, including Kri Uktiv, as sacred, always. Generally, but not always. At first, it sounds like anything you see in a Torah is sacred and original. Take a look at source number 5, which is the ideal example of this. The Gemara in Nedarim talks about, among other things, Mikra Sofrim V'itur Sofrim, the reading of the scribes, the ornamentation of the scribes. I'm not going into what those are right now, only telling you it has to do with the way that we write words in a Torah. And then it says, Kriyan V'lo K'tivan, K'tivan V'lo Kriyan, how something is to be read. Not written. Or so how something is to be written, but not read. All of those things Halacha Lemoshe Misinai. Now, the phrase Halacha Lemoshe Misinai requires some explanation, but the core of what Halacha Lemoshe Misinai means is, anytime you find a halacha, which Jews have always done, but there's no text in the Torah that tells you to do it, the Gemara says, it must be, this is what God told Moshe at Sinai. For example, having black tefillin. The idea that tefillin are supposed to be black. Halacha Lemoshe Misinai. There is not a pasuk you can find in the Torah that says that they should be black. There isn't even a drasha where you'll say, well, there's an extra letter here, or there's a link from this text to another. Nothing. What is it then? Says the Gemara. This is what Jews have always done. Must be that when God told Moshe what tefillin are, he told them that they're supposed to be black. And that's why they're always black. And we have dug up 2,000-year-old tefillin, and indeed, they're black. That's the way it's been. If you were to find 3,000-year-old tefillin, they'd be black also. So the point here is, this goes back to Moshe at Sinai. This is the way the text is supposed to be. But now here's something weird. The text here in the Gemara gives us illustrations of kri velo ktiv, ktiv velo kri. It gives us specific verses. Is there anything strange to you about the verses that the Gemara in source number 5 selects to illustrate this halacha lemoshe misinai? Is there anything odd about the verses that are chosen?
They're not in the Torah.
Yeah. Thank you. Gita points it out. There's only one of them that's found in Chumash.
One is Dvar.
Sorry?
One is from Dvarim.
Yes. One of them is from Dvarim, and all the rest of them are not. So how in the world do we understand, how can the text in Megillat Rut, to use our book, be a halacha lemoshe misinai? That doesn't make any sense to the way we understand halacha lemoshe misinai. So I'm going to give you three answers. This is not our main point, it's just you can't read this Gemara without it. I'm going to give you three answers. I wrote three explains, that's pretty funny. Three explanations for what this halacha lemoshe misinai means. The first explanation is the starkest approach. That's the Torah Tamima. And the Torah Tamima says, we have a medrash that says that Hashem showed all future generations to Moshe. So Moshe knew the whole story already. And he passed down to Yahushua how it should be written, and so on. It's passed down through the ages, and therefore we know how it was to be written. That is an extremely hard answer to accept. Because really, why did Shmuel bother to write Megillat Rut if we already had a text that Moshe conveyed? What exactly did Shmuel do? That's a hard one. The second approach comes from the commentator Alei Tamar on a passage in Yerushalmi, which we're going to see in a little bit. He says, no, that's not what we're saying. What we're saying is that the Anshei Knesset HaGedola, the Great Assembly, early in the Second Temple, they're the ones who are credited with canonizing Tanakh, and what they said goes, and it's as binding as if it had been given to Moshe at Har Sinai. He shows that we have other uses of the phrase Halacha Lemoshe Misinai that are like that. There's a Bar Tanura and a Rash on a Mishnah in Trumos, like that. Halacha Lemoshe Misinai does not mean Moshe heard this at Har Sinai. It means this is binding. That's the second approach. And then the third approach seems to me to be the simplest and most straightforward approach. And this is from the Maharal. The Maharal says, and I brought it for you in source number 7. Again, I'm sticking with my English because there's so much to talk about here. And I want to get through this. He says, meaning, he's explaining the Gemara in Nedarim, that it is a law given to Moses at Sinai that a book written with divine inspiration should have the text as appropriate and the pronunciation as appropriate. In other words, the Halach Lemoshe Misinai says that you're going to have two layers sometimes. There's going to be a text as written, and there's going to be a verbal read as well that is different. And the Talmud brings only as examples some words which are written but not read, some words which are read but not written, but these words themselves are not a law given to Moses at Sinai. It doesn't mean that the ones here were given to Moshe. Moshe stipulated that there should be a written layer and a verbal layer, because sometimes he's going to want to convey multiple meanings. But the specifics were set down by whoever wrote each book. So when you have in Ruth, the word Eli is not there, but you're supposed to act as though it is. Not that Moshe said, hey, there's going to be a word Eli in that sentence. Shmuel was the one who wrote the book. But Shmuel was the one who planned to omit Eli because he wanted this sentence to be read in multiple ways. You follow? It's not Moshe. Now, we haven't yet gotten to, I see Chana's hand, and I see a furrowed brow on somebody else here. We haven't yet gotten to the key question, which is, so what is Creek Tiv about? And Maharal's answer to the point of Halacha Moshe Misinai already tells you a little bit about where he's going to go with the idea, and I'm not ready to go there yet. So I'm not taking discussion right now about the two layers, because we have to come back to it. All I'm trying to do right now is to show you that the Gemara in Nedarim takes as a given that when you have these weird elements in the text, these artifacts, a spoken word, a written word, that it's all sacred. Similarly, you have a Gemara in Shabbos in source number 8 that talks about the origin of final letters in Hebrew words. You know that the letters Kaf, Mem, Nun, Pei, and Sadi have a form that they're written in if they appear in the middle of a word, and a different form as a final letter, right? Otiot Sofiot. You have your final letters as well, except for those who did Yeshaya with me, the Mem in Lamar Bei HaMisra. You may recall we had a Mem in the middle of a word that was written as a final letter. So the Gemara there says that the prophets are the ones who told us that if these letters appear at the end of a word, they're supposed to be written differently. And the Gemara says, I don't know what you're talking about. We have a principle that prophets aren't allowed to invent new things. Torah is Torah. Prophets are not allowed. The prophet's job is to reinforce the Torah that we've been given. The prophet's job is not to make up new things. So their Gemara's conclusion in source number 8, and we're not reading it inside right now, is to say that, you're right, they always had final letters as part of the alphabet. However, in the course of the Jews' exile in Babylon, they fell out of use, and the prophets had to reteach us the final letters. There was something that people forgot, they became sloppy about. I love to discuss final letters because it's a great discussion. There's a lot to be said. But it's going to take away from our main point. And the only reason I'm bringing it is to show you that as a general rule, we think of the text of the Torah as we have it as something that is holy and something that you don't just get to mess with. But on the other hand, take a look at source number 9. And this is the Yerushalmi that the Alei Tamar was commenting on. He says something very interesting about what happened at the beginning of the Second Temple period. Shlosha Sfarim Matzu Ba'azara. They found 3 Torah scrolls in the Azara. The Azara, main outer room in the Beis HaMikdash, in the temple. They found 3 scrolls. One is called the Ma'one Sefer, one is called the Zatute Sefer, one is called the He Sefer, based on certain unique words that appeared in each one. They got a name. In one of them, they found, towards the end of Sefer Devarim, Ma'on Elokei Kedem, right? If you've been in Shul on Simchas Torah, this is what's read as Chasan Torah for the last Aliyah of the Sefer Torah. So the word was written Ma'on without a hey at the end. In the other two, it was written Ma'ona Elokei Kedem with a hey. So they did it democratically. The Kimu Shnayim Ubitlu Echad. They upheld the text of the two and drop the text of the one. In other words, what this says, the Yerushalmi here is not talking about Kriyuk Tiv. What the Yerushalmi here is saying is that in Ezra's time, Ezra, who we call Ezra the Sofer, and we've talked about when we learned Ezra and Nehemiah what Sofer might mean. Does it mean scribe? Does it mean teacher? Whatever. Not the discussion for right now. But the point is that Ezra cleaned up the text of Sifrei Torah. He looked at what they had in the Beis Hamikdash, which presumably is going to be the place with the most authoritative scrolls, and where he found that that there was a version of the text, a variant, if you will, that appeared in the minority of scrolls, then it was outvoted and eliminated, and all the Sifrei Torah they created had to fit the dominant version of the text. Well, if everything in a Torah is holy, all the letters, written, pronounced, whatever, is original and holy, how in the world did you end up in this situation? And why was it okay to just answer the problems of these different texts by voting among them? What if you voted and you eliminated something really important just because it was in the minority among these three Sifrei Torah? We're not talking about testing 99 out of 100 here. You're talking about testing, you know, your three Torahs. That's all you got. This is a very difficult thing to follow. And how does this all relate to Kriktiv? Does it relate to Kriktiv? Or is it a separate thing altogether? So we have multiple theories about how to explain Kri Uktiv, and whether it is sacred, and whether Ezra was involved in it. We are going to bring four different approaches. Okay, everyone understands where we are? I've deliberately taken time to try to build this up in order to make sure that we follow what it is that we're talking about here. We have a dominant approach that says that biblical text is sacrosanct and everything in it, halacha l'moshe mi-Sinai, whatever that means, whether that means this specific point or whether that just means the concept of it. But no one's allowed to mess with it. And then on the other hand, you have Ezra voting among Sifrei Torah. So we have four different theories. The first approach is Radak. Radak's approach is the most down-to-earth, probably the one that most people would just assume, however, recognize that it got him in a lot of hot water. In his introduction to Tanakh, and then again in his commentary in Shmuel Bet, Perek Ted Vav, he says, you know what the answer is? The answer is, we Jews traveled from place to place to place. We had a hard time in our exile. And gradually, mistakes crept in. You're relying on the scribe to copy things over. Sometimes there's a community that only has one Torah. The scribe made a mistake in writing that Torah, and that mistake got perpetuated. So take a look at source number 10. He says, again, my translation, it appears that these words are thus, these words that are, you know, extra, missing, whatever, are thus because in the first exile, when we were in Bavel, books were lost, they were moved around, they meaning the people, the scholars who knew Torah died, the great assembly who restored Torah to its original state found disputes between the texts, like what we saw in the Yerushalmi, and they followed the majority as they understood them. And where they did not have a clear grasp, they wrote one version of it, did not assign it vowels, meaning you're not going to read it out loud, or wrote it outside and not inside, by which he means they assigned it to be a verbal thing, but not something written into the text. And so they wrote in one way inside and in another way outside. He says what happened was, hang on, Ricky, he says, and by the way, it's not just Radak. Radak, remember, you're talking about end of the 12th century, beginning of the 13th century in France. The Meiri is roughly that time as well in Provence. And he says the same thing in his commentary on that Gemara in Nedarim, as well as his introduction to Kiryat Sefer. He says, mistakes crept in over time, and sometimes you didn't know if it was a mistake or not a mistake. So what did you do? You preserved both. You had one as the written text, and the other was the way that we pronounce it. And that way we make sure that we preserve both approaches. Yes, Ricky.
I'm surprised by the way the third word says milot. I haven't heard milot. It's always milim. Is there a difference?
No. No difference. Don't worry about it.
Have you seen that before? Is it used?
Yes. Yeah, no, there are words like that that you see sometimes occasionally written in the opposite of the gender that you would have expected. The yes, Gita.
If one were worried about losing the Jews moving around so much, wouldn't it be safe to say that the Cree would be more safe than the oral?
So the Ktiv would be a more authoritative one, you would think, or a safer one, potentially. Maybe. Maybe, but not necessarily. For people who were so verbal in the way they studied Torah, I'm not sure. I understand why I would think so. But there's a whole school of anthropology which studies verbal traditions, and verbal meaning without a text altogether. And yeah, researchers argue that those are more accurate than texts that are transmitted in writing. Because these are the things that people learn, and they get to understand, and they memorize and transmit in a very careful way, as opposed to, you know, the old line, right? We write things down so that we can forget them. That's the truth. That's what we do. That's why we write notes. In school, in class, you know.
Okay, thank you.
Sure. So, this is one school of thought. This raises problems. Right? We saw the Gemara in Nedarim that said it's halacha l'moshe mi-Sinai. So, I don't know what Radak does with the Gemara in Nedarim. He doesn't say. What the Meiri seems to say is he takes the view that we brought as the second explanation of that halacha l'moshe mi-Sinai. The halacha l'moshe mi-Sinai just means it was authoritative. It doesn't mean that it actually is literally from Moshe. So, Ezra's job was to clean things up. And if they couldn't determine what was right, they kept both. However, Don Isaac Abarbanel comes along, and he says, that doesn't make any sense. He says, first of all, haven't you read the Rambam? The Rambam says, every letter of our Torah is right. What in the world is the Radak going to do with the Rambam? Says Abarbanel. That's objection number one. Number two, Abarbanel says, Radak himself knows that we always explain a pasuk, as I said before, based on the Cree, based on the way the word is written. That's the way the word is pronounced. How can you tell me that if we're preserving two equally valid traditions? Why should we always go with the Cree? And number three, he says, it should be a random mistake then. It should all be random. But it's not. The word Svoyim appears multiple times, he points out, and it's always written Tzadi Bet Yud Yud Mem. That doesn't make sense. It should be that if it's just random error that crept in over time, sometimes it should be Svoyim properly with a Vav, and sometimes not. The word Na'ara, right, is almost always written Na'ar in Chumash. Why would that be if these were just random errors that crept in over time? There should be no consistency to it. Says Abarbanel. So Abarbanel says, I'm going to give you an answer. And in giving us an answer, he gives us, I think, the reason why many people are extremely uncomfortable with Don Isaac Abarbanel. He says, you know what the problem is? Some of our prophets didn't know how to write. That's what he says. Some of our prophets didn't know how to write. He puts this in his introduction to Sefer Yirmiyahu. Sefer Yirmiyahu has a lot of these textual issues. Most of us wouldn't know that, because who really learns Yirmiyahu? That's a really, really hard book. But he says, he begins by saying that there are three traits that a prophet develops in, or that anyone really develops in terms of their intellectual abilities. There is personal purity and piety and spiritual level. There is your level as a speaker, and there is your level as a writer. Those are your three. So he says, as a Navi, as a prophet, Yirmiyahu is second only to Moshe. We saw that the Radak in Shmuel says that Shmuel is Rabban Shel Nevi'im, the master of prophets. Nonetheless, Abarbanel believes Yirmiyahu is second only to Moshe. And there are a lot of comparisons to be made between Yirmiyahu and Moshe, which are not our discussion right now. They might be our discussion if we ever get to discuss Eicha. But in any case, he says, Yirmiyahu as a Navi is off the charts. However, as a speaker, as a writer, he's no Yeshaya. Yeshaya, he says, that's someone who knows his way around language. Yirmiyahu? Not so much. And I brought you only a small piece of what he writes there. But if you ever want to learn Yirmiyahu, you really have to see what Abarbanel does. He brings you all sorts of examples of how Yirmiyahu has grammatical mistakes. It doesn't work as a book, which, interestingly enough, someone actually just complained to me the other day that Yirmiyahu talks about events and never tells you when they happened. I said, yeah, go read Abarbanel's introduction to Yirmiyahu. Look at what I did bring you here in source number 11, reading my English translation of it. He says, the third form of perfection, which is writing in a straight and precise way, I think Yirmiyahu also lacked that, for the reasons I've mentioned when he talked about why Yirmiyahu doesn't speak well. Meaning, he was a youth when he began to prophesy, right? If you remember, he says, Nar Anochi. So he says he started out as a youth. And so he didn't learn precise language, proper writing. And he says that's demonstrated by the phenomenon of words that are read one way, written a different way. Words that are written in the text, but we don't say them. Words that are read as though they were there, but they're not actually written. Which is found more in his book than in the other prophets. And he goes through it. He gives you a tally of how many examples of this are found in Yirmiyahu. And he says, and look at the text of Yirmiyahu, it's about as long as, I think he says, all of Sefer Bereishis and a little bit of Shmos. Yirmiyahu is a big book. And he says, when you compare it to those texts, and then he gives you another example, he says, I think he says it's as long as Yahushua and Shoftim combined. And he says, look for the mistakes in Yahushua and Shoftim, the textual problems, I should say, in Yahushua and Shoftim. He says, Yirmiyahu has way, way more than those other ones. He says, you want to know why? Because that was the problem in the way Yirmiyahu wrote. So he says, along came Ezra, and he said, I have to deal with this mess. And before Ezra was aroused to set vowels and cantillations and ends of verses, because you know that in the original text you don't have any of those things, he examined the text, and for that which seems strange to him in terms of the nature of language and intent of the story, he thought it was for one of two reasons. Either it was that the writer intended strange things which are secrets from the hidden elements of Torah, according to the level of his prophecy and depth of his wisdom, and so Ezra did not take on the task of actually erasing it from the texts of God, for he understood it was written with greater wisdom, and that for some reason the missing and added letters in strange forms were written. So Ezra looks at it and says, I don't know what to make of the problem in the text. Some of these are because Yirmiyahu is a very deep person who is hinting at ideas that we can't even guess. And sometimes it's because he didn't write well. So therefore, Ezra says, I don't know what to do. How do I deal with it? And so he left them in the text inside as written, but on the outside, meaning the Kri, what we read, he placed the pronounced word, which explains that strange written word according to the nature of language and the simple narrative. In other words, what Abarbanel argues is that you go with the written word. I'm sorry, you go with the spoken word as the accurate one, because that's the one that Ezra used to make the text comprehensible. That's the way that he reads it. And Abarbanel is going to have to read Halacha L'Moshe Misinai to apply to what Ezra did, right? Either saying Halacha L'Moshe Misinai, hangin', just means that the text is as authoritative as Moshe, or that Halacha Moshe Misinai was just that there should be multiple layers. He's going to have to deal with that problem, as well. Yes, Janine.
What was his second reason?
The second would be if it's just wrong, because Yirmiyahu doesn't really know how to write. Yeah, Abarbanel in this sentence starts a clause and doesn't finish it. Even as he's criticizing Yirmiyahu for his literary style. Yes, Hannah. You're muted.
Okay. today's Tuesday, and we said Shir Shel Yom. What does it say in Shir Shel Yom? The Hashem is Bekerb Elohim Ishmael. I think we're talking about Ezra and Beit Dino. And to me, I was seeing that Ezra had divine inspiration with his best deal. And that's why I accept the way that the mistake in the Torah is not a mistake, that Ezra knew what, that it's Meonai, not Maon. That to me seems clear. And also, I don't understand who was it, Ibn Ezra saying that only the Kree is, because we usually explain both.
So what you're saying, we're going to find reflected in the third and fourth approaches. But that's not where it's certainly not where Ibn Ezra is. And it's not what Radak and Abarbanel at this stage are putting out there. I mean, what I was going to say next is that the Malbim has a fit. He's not the only one. He's by far not the only one. But the Malbim writes his introduction to Yirmiyahu, and he begins with this, with all due respect, line where he says, you know, Abarbanel is Mishlomei Amunei Yisrael. I know he's a believing Jew. Really? And then he says, you have no idea what you're talking about. Flat out no idea what you're talking about. I was tired. I didn't bring it on here. I really should have brought it on here just so you could see Malbim go to town on Abarbanel. He's not the only one. Maharal also. He's like, he doesn't even quote him by name. He just says, yeah, someone wrote this and he doesn't know what he's talking about. He said, but Malbim's objection is, first of all, Abarbanel, you're making the process of prophecy and recording prophecy like that of someone who sits down, learns Torah, and wants to write a book. Like someone who sits down and learns Torah and wants to write a book, maybe a better writer, an inferior writer, so it goes. But these people are talking to God. This is prophecy. Further, Malbim says, God gives them the words that they're supposed to use. Now, the truth of the matter is that that's a problematic assertion, because we have the Gemara that talks about prophets having different styles and seems to say that prophets receive a vision and then they put it into their own words. But that's not what Malbim says here. He says they're given the words. Further, he says, if you're really going to say what Abarbanel says, you're going to open the floodgates for attacking the books of Tanakh. Well, this is a mistake, and that's a mistake. And in order to understand why that's such a big deal, you have to remember when Malbim lives. Malbim lives in the first part of the 19th century. He's dealing with early reform, right? Much has been made of this. I studied under Rabbi Elman, Rabbi Yaakov Elman, Alav Shalom. And he talked about the Malbim's emphasis on omnisignificance, the idea that everything in the Torah has a message. Every letter has a message. The choice of words has a message. Everything has a message. And he said some of that is a response to reform in his day, who are saying this is just a human text. He's saying, no, it's not a human text. You think that's just a synonym? That's not just a synonym. It's conveying this layer of meaning. Malbim looks at Abarbanel. He says, what have you done? You just messed everything up. And the Maharal, who is before reform, is apoplectic. He's like, he's just like, he's beside himself. So you should know that Abarbanel has another view that he also brings. And it doesn't bother him to bring both of these views in the same book. Take a look at source number 12. He says, and again, reading my translation, it is also possible to say that there are no mistakes in any of the holy texts of Tanakh. Phew. But that all of the words that are strange in their language and writing were recorded by the prophets thus intentionally and wisely. And for some reason, and we can't know it, for these are hidden elements of Torah and prophecy and our knowledge is far too limited to grasp it. But Ezra the Sofer did not analyze that which was beyond him, and he left words as written to hint to that which the prophets and those who spoke with divine inspiration intended. But he wanted to explain those words according to the pshat level. And that is what he did with the pronounced form. So he says, the other way to read this, and we already noted this when we saw Abarbanel, you know, minutes ago, about Kriyu Ktiv. He says, as he said there, maybe the answer really is that words that are strange in the Torah are strange for a reason. And when you see that there's an added, here's how we pronounce it instead of how we write it, That is because Ezra wanted to explain it in a way that people would be able to understand also. And that's why we always follow the Cree purpose. That's why we always follow the meaning of the way that it's pronounced, because that's just supposed to give us a read that we non-mystics are able to appreciate. And that's what Ezra was doing there, and that's the Gemara in Nedarim as well. That's a third approach. Last approach, and I know we're going down to the wire here. The Maharal himself, he says, you're missing it. He says there are two layers of meaning that are being conveyed. And this is the approach that the Malbim in his introduction to Yirmiyahu prefers as well. He actually writes it in a few different places. Take a look at source number 13. He says, one who knows matters of knowledge will know this. Know that the written form is from the text. For writing can only happen in a text. Writing is a text. And every sacred text is a text of wisdom. This is a little mystical. You got to stick with it. He says, the text is a thing of wisdom unto itself. But the pronounced form is not actually the text, only that people read aloud that which is recorded in the text. What you say is normally reading the words that are in the text, but it's really a separate thing. There is a written book, and there is a verbal book. Therefore, even if sometimes a different language is recorded in order to hint to some matter of wisdom or depth, that relates only to the writing. For the text is a text of wisdom, and one who looks at the text will find wisdom. But when one comes only to read from the text, it is appropriate that this be read in language that will be more comprehensible, for the written text is far from people's reading. In other words, what he's saying is, there are two layers in a text, and it goes back to his idea that the halacha l'moshe mi-Sinai is that there should be two layers. He says, the ktiv is drash. What you see in the ktiv is meant to hint at different things. The pronounced one, that's pshat. And he says, Yirmiyahu has more cases of this, because Yirmiyahu has more that he wants to hide within deeper meaning. Again, the Malbim likes this idea as well, and honestly, I think this is the most popular approach that tends to be taken among students of Torah traditionally. So, for example, if you were to look at the Midrashim en route, you would find back in chapter 1, sentence 9, it said, Umitzena Menucha. Naomi said to Ruth and Orpah, you should go find rest back in the home of your mother. It's written without a hey at the end, but it's pronounced umitzena with a hey. So the Medrash says, umitzena menucha, without the hey, means only one of you is going to find menucha, the other one will not. Or when in chapter 3, it said, Naomi said to Ruth, v'yaradit hagoren, you go down to the granary. However, at the time, Chana noted that it says v'yaraditi, I am going to go down. That's if you read the text itself. It has a yud. I am going to go down to the granary, says the Medrash. She's saying, my merit will go with you to the granary. That's the drash on it. So that what's happening here is we get two layers to the text. Then what did Ezra do? Ezra's talking about something else entirely different. Yerushalmi Tanis must be talking about something entirely different as far as the Maharal is concerned. He doesn't even address it. But again... To sum up, and I brought you review questions for this chapter as a whole, and I hope that you'll take a look at them and find them useful, because we're not going to do them aloud next time. But what I, hang on there, hang on. To sum up, what we're saying here is four different approaches. Approach number one, Radak, mistakes crept in over time, and that's why you have messes in the text. Number two, Abarbanel's main approach is, yeah, some prophets just weren't good writers, and so you end up with a mess like this. But Ezra just left it the way it was. He didn't want to touch it because sometimes it's secret. He didn't want to start messing around with that. Third approach, also Maharal, is that there are two layers of text because there are secrets in the text that made the text unreadable. And so Ezra tried to add a readable layer. And then Maharal, who says there are two layers of meaning that are being conveyed. There is the text that you read out loud, which is the more simple one, and then there are hints to greater meaning that are there to be found in the written text. There's more to be said on the topic, but hopefully this at least gives us an introduction to the range that you will find within traditional Orthodox commentary, let alone what you will find beyond. I'll stick around for a few minutes. Thank you, everybody, for letting me get through that in one day. I really appreciate it. Yes, Gita. You're muted. You're still muted.
Some people would like that. Okay. Is there any examples in the Chumash where there's a Kri Uktiv that has implications for halachic issues?
Kri Uktiv with implications for halachic issues.
Yes.
Well, but when I say that it has implications for halachic issues, what I mean by that is that you will find in the Gemara that they will actually give you a drasha using one layer or the other layer or saying, hey, there are two layers. Example, there's a discussion about if a person brings a karban chatat, how many placings of blood there have to be on the Mizbeach. And there's a big debate of how you know it. And one of the views that's brought in the Gemara is that the Torah uses the word karnot ha-Mizbeach, and sometimes it writes karnot with a vav, and sometimes without a vav. And so they say, well, there's no vav, that's singular. It's like it says karnat ha-Mizbeach. With a vav is plural, and so you count them up, and that's how you determine how many times you have to place, you know, it says one here and one here. That's what determines how many times you have to place the blood on the Mizbeach. And the trick is that the way our Gemara presents it is not the way our Sifrei Torah look. So it creates all sorts of problems. But that's a Kri Uktiv that's used.
Not quite Kri Uktiv. It's not quite.
Well, it is, because it's...
You're reading Karnat the same each time, even if it's Malay or Hasei.
But that's the point. Is that if it's really written Kuf Resh Nun Taf, you should be reading it as Karnat. It's
that's
written, its Ktiv is Karnat, and its Kri is Karnot. That's why I mean when I call it Kri Uktiv.
Okay.
Yeah. I see a bunch of hands. Rebecca, you were going to say something before? No? Okay. Janine, Chana, Jeanette.
It seems no? to me okay. that number 12 and number 13 are very similar. They both believe that there are two layers of meaning. It's just whether Ezra or anyone could understand what the hidden layer is. But they both say that they both have value.
So the difference is only who you assign the second layer to. Abarbanel says the second layer is being put in by Ezra in order to make the text more understandable. Maharal is saying that the second layer was actually original. He doesn't address at all what Ezra did. He doesn't explain the Yerushalmi. Yeah. Okay. Chana? You're muted.
One example of things that should stick to what it says is in Megillat Esther. No one knew before the new the trials why some letters are small. But now we know.
So I'm going to leave aside that story because there's a lot that's been written about that story in recent years. But Chana is alluding to the idea that the Nuremberg trials are hinted to in the large letters and that which is written differently in the 10 names of Haman in Megillat Esther. I don't really want to send you the articles I've seen about it because once you read that, you look at it differently. But there is such an idea that's as the story goes, Purimfest 1945. But look, certainly if one were to, I'm not going there. There may be meaning that we don't know about. Okay?
We don't know yet.
Correct. Correct. Okay, well, thank you very much, everyone. Next week is supposed to be the last week. I don't know how we're going to do all of Perek Dalet in 1 week. I don't know how that happens. We'll talk.
Thank you.
Yeah, Sandra.
I can reach you by email if I have a question.
So you have the source sheet?
Yes.
My email address is at the top. Or, if you want, just respond to the email that I send out.